Right. I mean, yeah. So the big thing. I hear the bell. That's the banana cart. There's a guy riding by on a bike with a banana cart. It's like chocolate covered bananas.
Hi, I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast.
Well, hi, I'm Ed Zeski, and I am a freelance writer and the author of several books, including Coffeehouse Theology and A Christian Survival Guide. I write at edzeski.com. It's edzeski.com. And I most recently self-published or independently published a book called Pray, Write, Grow, Cultivating Prayer and Writing Together. And I've kind of been on a bit of a prayer and Christian, or prayer and writing, writing Christianity kick lately. And so it's a book about how prayer and writing work together and help each other.
This episode of Spark My Muse is sponsored by the Daily Sharpening Ritual, a simple worksheet you can download and print for free that allows you to create a greater awareness in your life. Each morning and evening, for about 3 minutes, you write down just a few questions, answer just a few questions, and you'll be surprised within a week's time just how more aware you become. You have nothing to lose. Go for the link in the show notes at sparkmymuse.com, episode 14, and get a copy. And now to the wine segment. I'm not sure which wines pair well with chocolate-covered bananas, but a chocolate and wine tasting party is so much fun, and I'm going to give you a few key tips to remember if you decide to have a few people over for this fun event. For groups of 3 to 12 people, a chocolate and wine pairing taste testing party is just a great way to have a lot of fun and to have kind of an enhanced sensory experience that is memorable and will definitely enchant your guests. Because one of the tastiest things you can do is pair chocolate and wine. It's because chocolate and wine have higher levels of acidity and they make them a naturally delicious match. So consider inviting a few friends over to sample wine and chocolate. When you pair wine and chocolate, delicious qualities come out both in the wine and the chocolate, and then together they kind of create a new taste, a third taste. Have each person bring some wine, and I'll let you know some suggestions towards the end of this wine segment, and then you can provide some samples of high quality chocolate. Here's some ideas of which kinds of wines you can pair with which kinds of chocolates. Tip one, the most important tip to remember is to keep the wine sweeter than the treat that it's paired with. If you don't make the wine sweeter, it can have less flavor. The wine can have less flavor, and also it can bring out a bitterness in the wine that isn't all that pleasant. Tip two is make sure you have high quality chocolate. So leave the Hershey bars for the backyard s'mores and leave the Nestle Crunch bars for your trick-or-treaters. Go for something higher quality. Many supermarkets have a premium chocolate section, and you can get just one bar of each one or a good quality box assortment. And you, of course, can search online too. There's loads of chocolates you can get. You can get a sampler. Tip three, you get permission to taste test the chocolates ahead of time. Yum. This is a way for you to sample the chocolates so that you know which kinds of wines might pair well with them. Of course, wrap it up tightly after you're done, save it for your guests, and then see if you can pick out, as you taste the chocolates, maybe you can pick out certain fruit flavors and determine whether there's a sweetness or a bitter component, the acidity of the chocolate, whether it's a higher or lower acidity, nuttiness, and if the chocolate has a creamy center of fruit, it adds some complexity that you might want to consider as you're picking out wines. Tip four is a rule of thumb that you can remember. It's that darker wines tend to pair with darker chocolates, and they should be served first. You want to move from dark to sweet as you move through your tasting. So a more full-bodied or heavier, darker, and drier red wine will pair well with the more bitter chocolates that have a higher cocoa percentage. White wines tend to pair well with milk chocolate blends and chocolates that have sweeter and fruitier notes to them. And remember tip number one, keep the wine sweeter than the chocolate. Pick your wines according to the flavors you've already tasted in the chocolates, and then ask your guests to bring a specific variety of wine. Here's some ideas for specific wines that you can ask your guests to bring. And of course, feel free to experiment. You might prefer something different than what I'm suggesting. It's all part of the experimenting and discovering. So bittersweet chocolate is 70 to 100% cocoa. This is the real bittery kind, and it's much more, you know, there's a lot less sugar in these ones. This type of chocolate has a deep and rich intensity to it. And some good choices are Bordeaux wines from the Bordeaux region. Merlot, Cabernet Franc, Cabernet Sauvignon, Beaujolais, Shiraz, Port, Malbec. Those all make good choices. And of course, you can always ask at your state store if you're in Pennsylvania, because we're very backward here, or at your wine store. You can ask them, what are some darker, drier wines that they would suggest? Then comes dark chocolate, 50 to 70% cocoa. You can pair these ones with more robust wines such as Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Pinot Noir, or an off-dry Chamberson or Port. A Chianti can make a good match around the 65% cocoa content. Now for milk chocolate, as things start getting sweeter, you can try a Riesling, a Moscato, and more dessert wines. Champagne is also a natural pairing for milk chocolate. It has a crisp and dry flavor, but the sparkling bubbliness of the champagne, or what would probably just be sparkling wine if it's not from the Champagne region of France, makes the milk chocolate's fruitier flavors stand out more. And just be careful of the higher levels of sugar in the milk chocolate. They can wind up canceling out the fruitiness in dry wines and leaving them tasting bitter. Now, white chocolate, which is technically not chocolate, I'm not really a fan of it. It's cocoa butter, but a lot of people really enjoy white chocolate. It's got a smooth, rich creaminess to it, and it matches well with much more of the dessert wines. Sherry and Moscato, a fruity unoaked Chardonnay is a good choice, and these wines will pick up on that sort of the oilier notes and the buttery notes that come out in the cocoa butter. Another pairing is Vidal Blanc or Niagara and Catawba blends. Champagne is kind of the go-to wine that pairs with a lot of different chocolate types. Fortified dessert wines have a higher alcohol content, and they also tend to do well across the entire spectrum because they're on the sweeter side. So here's some tips so that your guests have a great time. Make sure to keep everybody sharp and feeling well, and offer your guests some bread or some light fare before you begin so that they don't get sleepy and have too much wine too fast. So this is how you want to conduct your tasting. First, you take a sip of wine and you really note all the aromas and the taste. You could talk about it. Some people have little sheets where guests will write down some of the things they taste, and you see if there's a consensus, or maybe someone has a very sensitive palate and they're tasting other flavors of the wine that are coming out to them. And you kind of note what's happening, and you really linger and experience that first sip and taste of wine after you've aerated the wine a little bit by swirling it around in the cup and really noting the smells and the taste. This is a real sensory experience. This is not a consumption experience. And then you take a bite of chocolate and really enjoy it and experience it and note all the flavors and the taste notes. And then you take a sip of wine again, and you will notice usually a dramatic change in the taste of the wine compared to the first taste that you had. And you don't want to rush through that. Allow people to really luxuriate on the experience and talk about the flavors. And even if it seems silly, it's something to really just enjoy together and to not feel like you have a deadline to meet to consume all of it. It's really a great life lesson too. So the point of life isn't just to bulldoze through and get through as fast as possible, but instead to really notice what's happening and take it all in deeply and downshift to better appreciate your encounters with other people, your encounters with the surroundings that you're in, and ultimately your encounter with yourself and to God who makes a home with us. It's a great way to slow down and start appreciating life in kind of a different speed. So enjoy yourself and let me know at the sparkmymuse.com website the pairings that you came up with or how your pairing experience went. If you have additional questions, leave them there at the website and I'll try to answer them in future episodes.
And then the next book I'm working on is going to be kind of more of a like a writer's survival guide if you're a Christian. So it's a how to basically writing without crushing your soul. Because I think there's a lot of aspects of writing that crushed my soul, and so and then when I talk to other writers, that's the same stories I hear. So just kind of digging a little deeper into what it looks like for a Christian to write and to kind of have a healthy balance.
Yeah, and I think you really are onto something because it can be, you know, the whole publishing a book is so different than the creation of one. And so what were some of the things that prompted you to kind of go in that direction?
Yeah, just so many conversations with other writers who had struggles with just the writing process, the publishing process, the marketing process. You know, there's so many people who were crushed by just, you know, different people not sharing their book that they hoped would share it. And that was hard for me too. There were just questions for God because I felt like I was being called to write and really pursue it as a career. I just felt like that was kind of, I tried every other option and it felt like the absolute last resort was writing. And it was like, God was like, kept shoving me in that direction. And then when I went to do it, it was hard. Like, it was incredibly hard and not very successful for a very long time. And even when I did have some success, like it was kind of spaced out so much that we still were really struggling in a lot of ways. And so, it just seemed like, you know, that alone was enough reason to pursue it. But then just as I've grown as a writer and as my faith has kind of evolved a bit, I feel like the two, you know, the practices of prayer and writing also are really connected in so many ways. And so there's just a lot to write about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you've kind of developed, your prayer life sort of developed and went in a different direction as through the process?
Yeah. You know, I was kind of the typical evangelical Bible thumper, you know, I journaled and stuff like that. But I kind of just talked a lot when I prayed, right? So like reading in the Bible about Jesus praying all night, I'm like, man, he must have like had a sore throat the next day. I've married into a charismatic family. And so I've been digging deeper into, you know, the charismatic experience and the Holy Spirit. And I go to a vineyard church now. And so just through my family, through my vineyard church, and just through people I've met, I've been learning a lot more about contemplative prayer, spiritual direction, you know, and just experiencing the Holy Spirit and the act of waiting on the Lord. And, you know, like so many times in the Psalms, it's just like, wait on the Lord, right? It's like, you know, and I feel like my prayer life for so long was kind of take charge, you know, like I'm going to tell God what to do. And it's like, well, actually the Psalms say to wait. And if you're waiting, you're actually not very active. And I know people say like, oh, it's very new agey, but it's like, well, if you look at what scripture says, it's actually, you know, this is ancient stuff that goes way back. And this is stuff that has been part of Christian history for years. And it's been traditions that have been passed on. And so, so my prayer life has been, you know, evolving over time. And as I developed those contemplative practices more and got more and more immersed in them, I felt like they kind of started to tie into my writing and vice versa.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, the type A personality or the productive person will usually tend to, and I know cause I'm guilty of it, is that we'll tend to think of prayer as like this proactive, you know, I'm going to engage with God and and then he's going to know I'm serious. and then I'll be very devoted. And I know that in my own life, as I started looking at apophatic prayer and things like that, was finding God in the silence and just abiding there and not doing all the talking too. And it was a lot of unknowing things, you know. And so it sounds like it's a similar situation for you.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's the thing. It's like, you know, and making the connection of prayer and writing, like I feel like the creative process in both praying, it's like you have to enter both with hands open. That you know, Stephen King talks about, like, writing is like you're kind of digging up the bones, like you're like excavating, like you're finding what's there. And that doesn't work for everybody quite the same way, but I feel like there is something to be said for you go into prayer with, you know, with hands open and to receive from God, and that you can't like determine the outcome, that God will just do what God wants. And also with creativity, with writing, you have to, I think if you sit down and you're like, this is going to be masterpiece, you know, soon. Yeah. And so you have to, what I tell people when I coach them is that you have to submit to the process, that you have to, you know, go in there and, you know, brainstorm, write down ideas, you know, outline, do a first draft, you know, revise it, you know, get feedback. Like, you know, you have to just kind of go into it with open hands, and by the time you've done it, it may look totally different than what you expected.
Yeah. And the creative process, does it tend to show up the same way every time for you? Or does you feel like God mixes it up so you find inspiration differently in different times?
Well, mix up what?
Mix up the process. Like you're talking about kind of doing the work and then allowing that to be fruitful. Do you find that the discipline of doing the work in a certain way helps you get more inspired, or do you think God tends to mix it up and that where you were once inspired, you no longer are inspired in the same by doing the same process?
Right. I think, you know, like the general principle, I think, and you know, and I've seen this in you too, with what you do, it's like it's a creating space. So like you make a space for it to happen. Like, you know, I see like you go on like retreats and stuff like that. And that's like, you know, if you know, like when I pray like right now, like I feel like, man, like I haven't really had a lot of experiences with God, or at least I haven't had a very deep experience with God in a couple of days. And it's like, well, my life has been kind of crazy the past couple of days. And it's like, I haven't made that space for that to happen. So it's like, not that I'm like a bad Christian or whatever. It's just that like, I haven't made that space because like, just life has been a little crazy. And so it's the same thing with creativity. And so you make that space and then different things will happen in that space. That's you know, that's one of the big things I write about in Prayer, Write, Grow, is that you make the space for the ideas to come to you, and it'll come in different ways in different moments. And sometimes you have to kind of write a lot of stuff and you pick the best things. And sometimes I'll be doing the dishes and it's like, oh, I've got something to do, and I'll take my dish gloves off and run out in the other room and write it down, you know? And so I think the inspiration and prayer, like it happens in different ways and shows up in different processes, but kind of the overall principle is to make that space for it to happen.
I was just listening to one of my absolute favorite podcasts is the Krista Tippett On Being podcast. It's some of why I was inspired to try it myself was just because I found that it was just chucked full of useful content that was just like just pure. It was kind of straight into my ears and straight into my brain. And I thought, that's got to be a good, like, I was attracted to the medium itself. And so what was interesting this week is that she has a guy on there, and I'm going to totally forget his name, which is going to be embarrassing, but I guess that's what show notes are for. But he was talking about, he was developing this practice of silence and solitude. And he was saying that more than ever, it's always been hard to find space, but more than ever, because we're plugged in and because of the way our lives are, we get a ton of information pouring in, but but less space to process that information than ever before. And so it's no wonder that we have to unplug basically and go back to some spiritual disciplines that remove us from all those trappings, because there's no time for our brain to actually just relax and stop multitasking, right, and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, people can't even stop at a stop sign these days without checking their phone. Like, I walk to the cafe by my house all the time, and I say the majority of the time when I walk past my street and there's a stop sign, there's someone at the stop sign looking at their phone. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like
not 1 second's wasted. It's
yeah. I mean, if you're like in a waiting room or if you're in line somewhere, like everyone in line's on their phone, and I feel that same pull too. I mean, and I used to be like Mr. Podcast. I used to have podcasts on all the time. Sorry, you know, not. I wouldn't do that for this one, but I used to have podcasts on all the time, and there was like never a moment my brain could just like slip into neutral. And that's, you know, and one of the things that I talk about in Prayer I Grow is that I didn't realize how crazy my mind was and how hostile a place my mind was for prayer and for writing until I started taking walks with my oldest son, Ethan, he's now like, you know, 2 and a half and he sleeps great. But his first year of life, he slept horrible. And we thought we were just completely incompetent, stupid parents, you know, and like none of the sleep books worked and everything we tried was terrible. So the only way I could get him to take naps was by taking walks. And I thought, you know, like I'm losing all this productivity time. You know, I'm gonna stop listening to podcasts during the walks. I'm gonna do an hour and a half of just like brainstorming ideas for writing. I'm gonna pray. I'm gonna have this like spiritual breakthrough. It's gonna be amazing. And I like drove myself crazy, and I was like freaking out. I was having anxiety attacks. You know, I couldn't like focus, and I was just like, it was one of those things where I couldn't be alone with myself. And so I had to like wean myself off, like, which is kind of embarrassing to admit, but like I set little goals. I would say like, well, if I make it to this bridge, I can, you know, then put the podcast on, or, you know, and then it became like halfway. And then, yeah, so at a certain point I was able to like wean myself off of the podcast during the walk. But that was a really big eye-opener for me.
It's like a detox, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, and that's interesting too. In just losing our sense of self a little bit, like we get a little bit scared of the quiet. And I know there was a woman who was a professor of mine who is a spiritual director, and she went on a 40-day, this sounds kind of crazy, but especially like when you have kids, you can't imagine ever doing this, but she went on a 40-day Ignatian spiritual retreat. And she, right? And so she has a bunch of different jobs, co-pastor of a church, really neat person, but she knew she needed, this was important for her soul kind of thing. So she did it, and she said it took 2 weeks for the chatter to die down because of all of the obligations of, you know, all the things she was trying to remember and everything. It took 2 weeks. Then all of a sudden, this yawning void of silence was there. The chatter had stopped finally. And she said it was so terrifying. She wasn't even sure what to do with herself. It was sort of like vaguely comforting in a way, but she felt really, really vulnerable and like alone, I guess you could say, until she felt found by God. But it was, I was thinking, you know, trying to imagine not being disturbed for 2 weeks. Can't even imagine that. But I can imagine that it's like sensory deprivation or something. At first, it's going to be like chilling experience. So, yeah. So what's the longest you think in the last like 5 years, what do you think is the longest time you've been able to unplug?
I was doing a thing, I do a thing over Lent where I stay like off my computer and social media and all that stuff every evening from 5 o'clock on, and then I also stay off on the weekends. Because I feel like for my work, I would feel like everyone I know who goes in these like 40-day fast social media, like they end up cheating a little bit. So I feel like I need to give myself like a mechanism to like, okay, like from like 9 to 5 on weekdays, I can be on social media. And the amazing thing is that, you know, like you're tempted to always be kind of compulsively on Facebook. And I would check on Monday morning, and you know, much as I love my friends, it's not like I missed anything like earth shattering. Like I could like read everything that I missed, and it was like, okay, like there is absolutely no reason why I had to read that on Friday night or Saturday morning. Like I could read it Monday morning just fine, and everything's great.
Yeah, yeah. And kind of along those lines too, I will occasionally see, the trouble is I've had some jobs recently, not freelance jobs, like longer term jobs, where it's part of my job to be on social media and post and whatever. And so then it creates a problem. You know, it's like you have to actually go on like a time off vacation. But I have done this thing where I don't take my phone. I leave my phone in my car when I'm eating out, or if I'm taking a walk with a friend, I just lock it in my car. And it's, you know, it's this false idea I came up with that somehow in 45 minutes time, like as if I'm like an ER doctor who's on call, you know, like I'm so important that if someone couldn't get a hold of me for 45 minutes, you know, the universe would start to shred or something. You're like, right. And that false premise of thinking that you should be reached and that it should be easy to find you. And there's like, you know, 0.001% of the time where it is maybe life or death, and you really do right. need, but chances are, even if it was life or death, it still could probably wait a half an hour. It would probably wait, right. I probably couldn't get to the hospital fast enough anyway, you know, and all that stuff. And so I wound up doing that, and I felt so much less anxious than I thought I would feel. Like I thought I would really miss it and be kind of pent up, and actually it was like, ha, no one can reach me. It was a right. totally opposite kind of reaction. But
well, I mean, I used to drive back in, you know, the late 90s, I would drive 12 hours from New Jersey to my college in Indiana, you know, with no cell phone. And I mean, people died all the time because they didn't have cell phones in the car. You know, like they like would pull over and didn't have a cell phone and they'd just die. You know?
Yeah.
It was terrible. Like, we had, you know, a funeral every week at my college because of all the college students who were driving in cars and didn't have cell phones. I don't know how I survived.
Yeah. I know, right? It's such a new thing. Like I was trying to explain that to my daughter too. And I said, This is how I did it. If I was at, and I did a lot of sports in high school, and I didn't have a ride home, I didn't have a car, and usually, you know, I lived far enough out of the way that no one could drop me off. So I would make a collect call, and my dad would answer the phone, "You have a collect call from pick me up."
Yeah.
And he wouldn't accept the charges, and then he'd come get me, you know, like 45 minutes later he'd arrive, and it was, that was our little system. But it was like, if you happened to not be near a payphone, you were kind of just screwed, you know, more or less. You had to hope for the goodness of others or something. And we actually survived. Like I survived my childhood and everything. Who knew, you know? But that's kind of been my, you know, my son is 15 and my daughter's 12, and they don't have cell phones. They have iPods that they can text me, but they have to be on Wi-Fi to be able to do it. And you know, my daughter was convinced that this was going to potentially be a life-threatening situation. And I said, the thing is, all your friends have cell phones. You're actually kind of covered. Like you're always going to be with them, right? So you just borrow the phone right. for like 15 seconds. So I think, you know, and these perilous, the things that seem perilous or aren't really, you know, they, you know, maybe once in a while, if you broke down, that would really stink to not be able to call a tow truck, but you know, right. probably someone would call for you.
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean, and the funny thing is too, like, you know, you mentioned about the anxiety, like being less anxious. Mm-hmm. Like, I think we tend to think of, you know, not to be like Mr. Luddite here, but like, I think we always see like the net good of technology and forget there's also something you lose, right? And so not that we like reject it, you know, completely, but I think that we need to also keep the negative sides in mind. And one of the things I've been seeing a lot lately is like these studies coming out of the UK about like the anxiety of teenagers right now. And it's this like they're compulsively checking social media and stuff like that on their phones. And it's like, did my friends like my post? Did my friends like my picture? And it's like this, this constant anxiety and checking that not everyone has, but that it's something that like they're reporting higher levels of stress and anxiety. And so, you know, when you think about, if you're maybe like waiting in line or if you're hanging out at home on the couch and maybe like you'd be reading a book or newspaper or whatever in the past, and you'd actually just kind of be resting and reading. And now today it's, you're tempted to be on social media, and it's actually making, it might actually make you more anxious. Like, it's not like, a one-to-one comparison of like, well, I'm just reading Facebook instead of reading a newspaper or a book. It's actually like, this is something that, that could be causing anxiety or could make you more depressed because you see everyone's quote unquote perfect life, you know, or their perfect dinners out with friends, and you feel lonely. And you know, it's like, there is a drawback to it that I think that we can overlook. And like you said, like until we step away from it for a period of time, we don't know what that drawback is.
Yeah, for sure. And it's because of the social connection that it's not neutral media like it would be for reading a book, or you know, you're not consuming in a neutral way because there are some social stakes at play that kind of weigh in on that, and you realize, you know, if something's going to blow up, if I'm going to say something and I'm going to have a whole bunch of people respond, you know, it's a totally different world than just, you know, listening to the radio or, you know, reading a journal or something like that. But, well, tell me a little bit more about how you've laid out your book and, you know, some of the highlights or topics that you're covering in a little more depth.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing is that I think people tend to, and this is something that I thought is, you know, if you're struggling to write or you're struggling to pray, you know, we tend to think like, oh, like I just don't have it. Like God's not with me, or I did something wrong. If prayer's not working, or if you're, you know, struggling to write, it's, well, because there's obviously something wrong with me. And I think that like a lot of times the problem is simply just making that space to grow and pray and write. And so as I kind of explored that further, I felt like I kind of kept seeing these connections between how I prayed and how I wrote, and how I would, you know, I do the Ignatian Examen every night, and I use an app. It's called Examen, but it's misspelled. It's Examine. It's an iOS app, but I do that. I was doing that every night, and what I was finding is as I was doing the Examen, I was coming up and I would pray. I would, you know, you kind of say what went good from your day, what went bad. Are you hopeful? Are you discouraged? And I was finding that as I did that, I was coming up with writing topics too. So for instance, I was, you know, listing like what was the best part of my day, and like the best part of my day for a couple of months was like, well, I accomplished this while writing. And then I realized after like, you know, maybe 2 or 3 months of this is to my shame, that like I wasn't saying like my kids are happy and healthy, or you know, my wife and I had a nice chat after dinner. You know, like it was like, see, so I saw that the balance in my life had kind of has shifted more toward work, and you know, which is a major temptation as a writer, because you're always trying to get more work in the pipeline and make your projects more successful so that you can, you know, pay your rent. Yeah. Like it's an understandable problem, but it's still a problem. And so yeah, and then as I wrote about things, I also gained some clarity that I could, you know, pray more. And so I was starting to, you know, I was able to deal with some of my workaholic tendencies, my insecurities, my anxieties, like all those things came into sharper focus. And the two practices almost kind of became this one and the same. Yeah. They kind of sped each other.
Yeah. And so now do you have some of those spiritual disciplines kind of outlined in the book, or is it just more of like your story of how you've worked through those things?
Yeah, and I talk about, you know, what I do for Examen, and I have some resource notes at the end of the book, you know, with links to different sites to try different things out. I also have a resource page on my blog associated with the book that has all the, you know, all the links that are in the book are on my blog too, in case people want to just see those. So it has like practical stuff, and also has kind of my story of kind of figuring out, you know, how prayer and writing kind of work together.
Yeah. And then there's also, you have had a Facebook page where you've kind of invited people to come along. I guess it's still, I think it's still a public page, but you might make it, maybe make it private. And then what I was wondering, has that group or the response to that surprised you, or is it kind of what you assumed would happen because there's a need that's a similar need to yours?
Yeah. So the group's called Contemplative Writers, which it's really funny. Like I've been thinking about doing this for like months, and I was like, well, there's obviously already a group called Contemplative Writers, and there wasn't. Like I was like, oh, this is awesome. And so I was just praying one day, and I was like, you know what? Like I should just start this group, because I bet you there's got to be a couple people out there who, you know, are dealing with this. Like the reviews for Prayer at Grow are really positive. People really found it helpful. Mm-hmm. And so, so I just started it on a whim, and a couple people joined in, and it's going to be like open to anybody. I might make it private at some point just because people might feel more comfortable sharing in a private group, but it'll be open for anyone who wants to ask to join it. I'm not going to make it like secret or anything. Mm-hmm. Obviously Kristen Oliphant is a great disappointment. No, just kidding. Sorry. The group has been really good because I feel like everybody's just in a different place, right? Like there's people who are just getting started out, and they have all this insecurity and angst, and they just don't know. And so we can kind of just, you know, give information and you know, kind of guidance on like what to do. And other people are, you know, further down the road, and like, you know, yourself and, there's Andy Floyd, you know, like, and she has a bunch of stuff going on. And so, yeah, I feel like we have people who can really kind of like I'm not like running the group really in a hands-on manner, but there's like a lot of different people who have a lot of experience and expertise in different areas who can really add a lot to the discussion. So I feel like it's just like a really cool space where everyone's just coming from different angles, but you know, it's been a really positive experience so far.
Yeah.
I'm rambling.
Yeah. you're not, you're fine. But yeah. And I noticed on the group that, it's pretty obvious that people are coming from different places, but everybody's kind of contributing sort of in a generous spirit, which is not that that's a surprise, I suppose, but it's kind of low pressure or something, you know, it's in a good way. Like here's something you might want to try, or this helped me, or something like that. It's more of like it's kind of like support group or something
right. You know? Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly what I was hoping to do, actually, is just to kind of say like every day or a couple times a week, just kind of throw something out there and just say like, hey, here's something to read or think about or try or talk about, and just kind of give everybody like a little, like a small win, right? Like just like, here's just something we can all talk about if you want. But yeah, absolutely. It's like low expectations, but just kind of share what you want. And people have really stepped up.
Yeah. Well, you know, that kind of... Oh, I hear a car starting. I'll have to edit that out.
Yeah, I'm on my porch.
I hear these little, like, you know, ambient sounds, and sometimes Skype will hear these ambient sounds and it'll freak out and it'll sound like, blah, 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 you know, you're like, oh crap, it's like everybody's underwater. But here's, you know, what you say brings up an interesting point, because as I was reading your blog lately, you were covering some pretty heady topics. I guess the bigger question is, how do you deal with really heavy topics like sexual abuse or, you know, some scandal or something like that as you write about them, and not get like trapped into like a spiral of depression, or like, how do you reach a balance? Like what are some of the things you've done, or have you not reached a balance, I guess?
It's very easy to lose balance and to kind of just give into your anger. There are emails certain people I haven't like written yet who I feel like need to be confronted about things, and you know, just like I don't feel like I'm in a place where I can do that with a generous spirit or a redemptive approach. I'm definitely like a big fan of Richard Rohr and his stuff about, you know, true self versus false self, and that we, you know, we act out of our identity in Christ, and you know, and to not, so it's a kind of a generous, redemptive approach to other people, right? So it's that, you know, Jesus wants to redeem everyone, and so that, you know, what I do and what I say has to have a redemptive approach too. I don't want to fall into a trap of like kind of a dualistic thing. And that's, I mean, obviously, like, let's just be honest, right? That's like what sells a lot for like blogging. Like you can start up a blog and build a platform really quick if you find someone to hit. And it's much harder to take an approach that's redemptive. And that's something that, you know, I try to do that with my writing. And I think that, I think you can give people a push. I think that you can, yeah, so I wrote a blog post. What you're referring to is about the Village Church and their failure to react with compassion, which was their word, toward a former missionary whose husband had been both a pedophile and had been viewing child pornography. And I wrote a blog post. I feel like, I'll just be frank, like if you write about, if you like put out information about like here are best practices for protecting children in the church, like, no one's going to share it. No one cares. And they care, but like they're not. They're going to be like, well, it's not my church, so you know, we're good. And it's just not like on people's radar. And so I feel like I needed to, as a writer, as a creative person, I wanted to get people to kind of stop and think twice about this. So I titled the post, I'd rather be an atheist than attend the Village Church, which is the, you know, the church in question here. And I was angry. I'm still angry about it. And you know, curiously enough, even someone from the Village Church reached out to me, and you know, the person asked to remain confidential, and the content of the email to be confidential. But you know, speaking generally, like the point of the communication to me was to point out the missionary who had been, you know, put under church discipline for just wanting to annul a marriage that was built on a lie. You know, it was basically trying to point out how terrible that person was. the message didn't get through. And so, you know, I want to help the people at the Village Church to make better decisions, to be more redemptive. You know, and so I'm gonna push them. I'm gonna, you know, say hard things, and I'm gonna say it in ways that are provocative. But I'm also, if I don't feel like I can write or speak in a you know, a kind, redemptive way, I'm gonna have to wait and hold back. You know, so definitely waiting is really important. And you know, you have to think about the end goal, right? Like, so just to pick a topic that's kind of been close to my heart over the years has been women in ministry. And you know, you can get really in really like frustrating conversations with, you know, like I affirm women in ministry, and there are lots of Christians who don't. And you know, everything that I believe about that has been hard fought. Like I've switched sides in the whole thing. Like, you know, I'm not just like some fluky guy, you know, who's like, I'm going to just make the Bible say whatever I want. And, you know, people can kind of come and be like, well, you know, you need to just pray about this. And if you really love God, you'll figure it out, you know, that, you know, women should teach whatever. And, you know, I try to think about, like, well, what changed my mind, right? Like, I needed, like, time to study, and I needed to hear stories. I needed to engage Scripture and to see different ways of reading Scripture and to see the inconsistencies of my approach. Yeah, so like I needed like a lot of time and a lot of patience. And so, you know, I think it's so easy to start like that dualistic thinking of like, well, we have two different sides, and you know, it's a very like short game approach. And I think we have to play the long game. I think that's how God deals with us, right? That God's, I think God is all about the long game with us. And so when I deal with a controversial issue like this, it's to think like, okay, I don't want to, you know, attack, you know, these people to the point that they feel like they couldn't approach me in the future.
Hmm. Yeah, and kind of what you're talking about is this, what settles so many things is just heightened empathy.
Right.
You know, our own empathy, but also doing things that engender the empathy of others. And I think you've actually done that really well by sharing people's stories, where someone can read it and, oh, I never saw it like that because I didn't know what that person felt like, you know. Yeah, and it's part of the job of the writer, the person, I guess, the person who feels called to communicate, right, and for a bigger, something bigger than themselves, is that, am I able to show people something that they haven't seen, but then once they see it, that they know it's true, and they can't unsee it.
Right, and to feel it too, you know, to feel that person's feeling.
I will like put some links in for this, and then I hope that in a couple months maybe you come back on and give an update, and we'll dig into something else maybe if you're able and willing.
Absolutely, yeah, that'd be great. I really appreciate you having me on. It's been fun. Thanks, Lisa. Bye bye.
Subscribe to the podcast and stop by sparkmymuse.com and leave your comments.